Hello, and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the Ag Vendee Group. I'm Sarah Nollet. Right now, there are a lot of existential threats facing global agriculture. Climate change, shifting consumer preferences, growing and aging populations, human health concerns, the list goes on. But there's also conviction that solutions exist, and that more are on the horizon, if, of course, we invest in them sooner rather than later.
And we know that to develop a biological product costs many millions of dollars. It needs to be supported by science and takes probably 5 to 7 years. So unless we get cracking now on it, I think we're going to have a distinct disadvantage on the global marketplace by 2030.
That's Ben Barlow. He's the managing director of New Edge Microbials. But Ben started out as, and continues to be, a farmer. In addition to growing crops, Ben and his family have been investing in businesses around the farm gate for decades, owning companies and acquiring assets with the help of a group of collaborators. He's turned growing up in agriculture and a life in ag banking into a portfolio of investments that are as much about the future of his farm as about the future of farming writ large. But let's start at the beginning. All of this work began when Ben first wanted to come back to the farm after college.
When I finished uni, things were fairly tough in agriculture in Australia. There were really high interest rates and commodity prices were terrible. And that was in the early 90s. And my old man actually said, go and get a job. So I went and became a bank teller in Mildura. And from there, I had a really good career in banking, particularly agribusiness. And that led me to Sydney. And then after that, that led me to the United States for a while. And then after about 20 years in it, I decided that it would be time to go back to farming. But in that 20 years, my wife and I had put together about 80,000 acres of hay. So we had an operating business up there that we'd been running from a distance for many years. So we went from high-end corporate life to living in the lignum at Booligal. And that was great for a few years. And then we sold that to a corporate investor and then made various agricultural investments after that, which was about 6 years ago.
When you were working in the banking world, especially in agribusiness banking, I always think that bankers have such a unique view on agriculture, talking to a lot of different owners and operators and different financing models and different operating models, different decisions. They're in some pretty deep and personal business conversations. What were some of your insights or lessons from that time in banking?
Well, it was a great career because it traversed credit and marketing and developing the agribusiness platform that we built in the United States. And you learn a lot about what makes a business work well, I think, because you see such a wide variety across your desk over a long time, you start thinking about where the good opportunities are and why people are successful. And predominantly, there's opportunity everywhere, I think. It's actually the culture and the people that come in behind a venture that create the real value and momentum. I often say, we do a lot of things that a corporate would do in a family company. We do disc profiles, for example, in all our staff and 360 feedback as you would in a corporate operation. Our systems are all geared as you would in a public company. In-house counsel, analyst capability, all the things you need to stay on top of the game. But really, it's the understanding of the leadership team and operation of one another that creates the momentum and the value. If you know your own self a bit and you hire people that complement your shortcomings or looseness, I call it, it really adds to the success. And it can be marketed well, but you've got to have substance underneath.
What have the conversations been like as you talk about whether it's a disc profile or having company values, some of these things that especially in agriculture can seem maybe a bit squishy or a bit too corporate, like hasn't always been the way things have operated. Have you gotten any pushback from people you've looked to hire or work with?
No, we don't. Everyone we've hired, sort of a company principles, if you like, are fairly grounded and earthy. And the way we operate is long-term and strategic. We're not driven by the investment cycle to date. We might be one day, but we'd be ready for that. It's more of, it's sort of the serious fun, I call it, in the business, where there's a culture of being open and having fun with one another and achieving some pretty amazing things, which requires a lot of time, a lot of long hours and focus. But that's what attracts people. And I was only thinking about this the other day. I was looking at the staff, particularly at NEM and the structure here. And we're an ag company. We're 50% male, 50% female. The leadership team's 50-50, and the average age is probably under 40. And that's across the whole operation. It's about creating opportunity. Ag's a bit sexy now, I must say. It attracts good talent. And I think COVID's helped too, Sarah, by some very good people that have gone to the city for a career have wanted to come back to a good, strong region and pursue their career and skill set in a regional setting in the last couple of years. So that's, we've really benefited from that.
Tell me about your time in the US, Ben, jumping back to when you were in the banking world. What were your observations looking back in on Australia from overseas, or anything you said, oh, we're really doing that well, really doing that poorly, looking outside in?
There's always the cultural differences, isn't there, of trying to develop an international business. I was based in the Midwest, so I guess the Midwest is very similar to regional Australia, although I did spend a fair bit of time in New York as well. But the Midwest of America, I think, is very much like Australia. So that made it reasonably easy. The learnings I've had from it is that it's difficult to run a business on the other side of the world. You know, it's not easy. And I think my learning from that is that seek strategic partners around the globe that you can work well with and let them run that part of the business and really leverage that strategic partnership to create a great outcome.
Now, was it when you were in the US that you started to develop this idea of a kind of wider than the land investment thesis, going both sides of the farm gate, so to speak?
I've always thought we should do that, only because I think there's some really good regional businesses around the place that are unique. And I've always thought, you know, it takes the cyclical nature of farming or the annual income situation of farming out of the equation, which is always handy, particularly, you know, in ag. I think what drew me to it was I went to Israel in about 2016, I think it was, and I was looking at water use efficiency, but I actually stumbled onto biologicals while I was there and plant breeding and other bits and pieces. And I came back and I thought, gee, that looks really interesting. I wonder if there's anything in Australia that is like that. And so I did my research, as you would normally do, and there was only one company really of any substance in this space, and it was here in Albury, which wasn't far away from where we relocated to. So I met the owner, who's still a shareholder and on the board, and we spent about 18 months together looking at the company and working together and seeing if we liked one another. And then Sandy wanted to retire, so we did a structure whereby some of our family members came in. Sandy retained some equity, and with a pretty clear strategy, we invested a lot of money on global research about where we sit in the global marketplace and what we could potentially do with it. And that led us to acquire it and get cracking. So I've always been curious to look at outside investments, and it just happened to be that when I was in Israel, I thought investments that have high barriers to entry in agriculture, which is strong, and particularly in the biological space, which is growing because of consumer sentiment, is somewhere where I think we should be.
I was going to ask why a biologicals business versus, you said you were looking at irrigation and other inputs. What really drew you to biologicals?
What really took me there was it's a difficult business. There are really high barriers to entry. There's proprietary strains and proprietary formulations, and there's also really strong regulation around it. So all those provide pretty strong barriers to entry. To start a biologicals business, knowing what I know now, I think it had cost several tens of millions of dollars and probably a decade to get to the point where you've got the market share we have. It's probably better to look at it in that context and say, it's a great business, it's in a good space. How do we actually transform the business to take advantage of global trends? And if you look at what's going on around the world now, you know, and you look at the growth in biologicals, you know, it's growing at, you know, 15% compound annual growth every year, maybe more, depending on where you read it. So if you're not growing at 20% as a business, you're probably not keeping pace. And that's about where we pitch this business. We were probably 90% domestic 3 years ago, and that's changing to be, the balance is changing to international and domestic.
That shift from more of a local and regional focus to eyeing more of the global picture has allowed New Edge Microbials to expand not just geographically, but also into new products, crops, and markets.
We're expanding now with our research projects into cereals and all seeds. and corn, chasing, the, I guess, the bigger addressable markets. Our products today, right now, we service about 800 distributors here and abroad. And on the last count, I think annual production treats about a bit over 2 million hectares of legumes a year. So that's a really good base from which to grow. We have some formulation techniques which allow us to, traditional inoculants for legumes would be in 3-litre bottles or 2-kilogram packs to treat a tonne of seed. We have proprietary technology that allows to treat a tonne of seed with a concentrated vial that weighs 30 grams. So that's given us a global advantage and an intercontinental advantage where we can put a lot of value on an air freight pallet and have it overseas within 48 hours, as opposed to a 40-foot shipping container where the shipping costs are 9 months' wait now are causing real problems.
Though the business is continuing to gain momentum and grow, as measured by both physical expansion, like building plants, as well as hiring employees, challenges remain.
A challenge, of course, is to run the business really well and run our research and development programs really well that open up these new frontiers. I take a view that when I look at what's going on in Europe, for example, today, I think there's 194 biological registrations sitting in front of the EU and only 3 for chemical. I look at the EU saying chemical and fertiliser applications have to reduce by 25% by 2030, which is an opportunity for us and has created opportunity. But I look at the Australian system and I say, we might wake up as farmers and find that our clean and green image here in Australia is no longer the same in terms of chemical residue or our carbon footprint. And we know that to develop a biological product costs many millions of dollars. It needs to be supported by science and takes probably 5 to 7 years. So unless we get a cracking now on it, I think we're going to have a distinct disadvantage on the global marketplace by 2030. And that's what drives me, Sarah, to head down this path to underpin our farming operations with science, but also to be prepared, which I think the inevitable consumer sentiment around the globe is going to bring that to our table pretty shortly.
And what are the conversations like, Ben, about that with farmers, customers, whether it's distributors, agronomists, or farmers that you talk to around that risk and that shift? Is it accepted or resistance, or what are you hearing?
Mixed bag. So we've actually surveyed a large cohort of farmers, agronomists, and distribution to understand their sentiment. I'm certain that from that data we've collected that there's an appetite for biologicals because we all understand as farmers that we've been mining the country pretty hard for the last 30 years with rotational cropping and that we're putting more and more inputs in and they're getting more and more expensive. There's an appetite there, but there's also a scepticism of it. And I think that's been because there's been a lot of attempts made to put biologicals into the marketplace that haven't been underpinned by deep science because the companies that do it just don't have the resources. I think some data, Sarah, had, there was something like 530 biological companies around the globe. There were only, I think, about 22 that turned over more than 10 million US, and the majority of them didn't turn over much at all. So they don't have the resources to spend several million dollars a year on R&D like we do. And I think that's the advantage. We've been supplying our farmers now for 20 years with legume inoculants that they know work. The stats are really simple. The inoculation of legumes in Australia saves the equivalent of about $5 billion worth of synthetic nitrogen being applied a year, or produce the equivalent of 3 million tonnes of nitrogen a year in an Australian cropping system. So we figure that if we invest really heavily in science and we can actually produce something that works in the bigger crops, and it works in the Australian cropping system, which we understand, and not try and change it, then we've probably got a pretty good opportunity that they might accept new products. But we have partnerships with certain universities and CSIRO, and CSIRO does all our independent assessment of what we're doing. And we've taken the decision that when we go into trials in next year with some cropping groups and we'll expand it, that we're going to produce all data for farmers to understand the Growing Better program. A lot of companies produce their own data and sometimes they might do a number of trials and only present the results from the best ones. So we're going to do something different, and we're going to produce the results from all of them, and we'll talk to farmers very transparently and say, oh, we succeeded or we failed, but you're on the journey watching. And I think that's the only way to go, right? It's about being transparent and taking time and doing it properly. And I think that also means that we're saying we're serious about it. We're not rushed to get a product in a box by a certain time because our investors want an immediate increase in value. We've got time on our side to do a really good job of this. And that's what we intend to do, yeah.
What's your sense, Ben, of there's been quite a few many millions now spent in the venture capital world on different companies with biological solutions of different kinds, some out of Australia and some overseas, and they would have some of that pressure around timelines, yet they also have potentially deeper pockets in the near term, different kinds of resources. What's your view on the entrance of venture capital into this space?
I think capital into this space speeds the process up. It's how you apply the capital, isn't it, at the end of the day, and what you seek to achieve. If I categorise the firms in this industry, there are those that have a biological that's got promise in the laboratory and they're raising capital. That's a long, long way from the laboratory to being in a box and producing it at scale and getting it across 70% of the market. A long way, many millions of dollars and years. There are a few companies that can take a strain, if you like, of the bug and research it through hothouses, through trials, formulate it and get it in a box and distribute the market. There's probably only 10 of those companies in the world that have the full suite from one end to the other. So I think the capital coming in for the discovery phase is really good. But I often wonder what happens after that, Sarah. If you discover it and it works, then what happens after that? I guess it's a licensing model for them to license that technology around the world or to sell it. For us, it'll be to actually produce it at the end of the day.
So, and do you see changes to how those value chains work? Like some of the big chemical manufacturers are looking more at biologicals. You've got different agronomy groups doubling down on advice around the use of biologicals. You've got bigger farms bringing in-house agronomy, dealers bringing in-house agronomy. How do you see the landscape of that kind of go-to-market and confidence and advice changing as we shift to more biologicals?
I think the issue is if you want to go direct to farmers, it's a long slog to sell volume and you need a big sales force to go farmer to farmer. The only way to do it with scale is through distribution. The ag distributors around and they're very skeptical and want to see the data and the science. And so in order to get into those big markets, you've got to produce the data and I guess have a brand and a reputation that they're prepared to accept your product. Hence why I think the work we've got to do in this new frontier has to be really transparent and validated by third parties in order to have acceptance.
And you've said the word partnership a few times, whether that was in the banking days, whether that's university partnerships to do the research, whether that's partnering with distributors. What are some of your lessons around partnership? It's easy to say and all sounds good, and yet in reality, forming a partnership that's mutually beneficial is pretty challenging in my experience.
We have a number of very nice partnerships everywhere from science to distribution, pretty well across the business, but it comes down to not rushing in, getting to know one another and seeing if your principles align before you start. Our scientific partnerships, for example, have been formed by acquiring what I've termed well-researched material that's been researched over the last 30 years in Australian universities, but haven't been able to be commercialised. For one reason or another, because the research programs have ended, or there's lots of reasons, or the paper was published, or there was no commercial appetite to do it. I'll give you the idea of partnership in science is to actually to acquire that intellectual property, retain the scientists that have developed it in a commercial project to get it into a box, and in that agree that we'll pay a percentage of our revenue back to further research. So that's what I call a great partnership. It transcends time and it's in for the long run. It's good for the company because we've acquired the IP. It's great for the researchers because they have a secure source of funding and it's an applied project to get that research into a box and make a difference. And the reward, of course, is further research funding coming back. So if you think of this business, it's a really complicated business, but it's a really simple model. It's more products that we develop go into the hands of our existing farmers or new farmers that we're doing business with around the world, which creates more revenue and more profit for them, which allows us to spend more on research, which allows us to develop more products. And that's the flywheel of the business. It's really simple, as easy to understand, but quite complex underneath. But that's what we do. I can see us in the next decade being one of the largest private research funders in the country, all out of retained earnings.
I wanted to ask about that, the growth that you've experienced over the last couple of years. You said sort of 18 to, you know, 50 people and expanding presence, building some of those systems. Any growing pains or examples of the mistakes that you made along that journey? I always think that those are insightful lessons to share for others trying to grow businesses.
Doing things urgently that we probably didn't think about or research well enough. I think the other mistake we made too is we were growing very fast and we didn't have the human capital behind us. You know, we're working pretty long hours and didn't have a lot of time to reflect on the business and the strategy and where we want to go. But once we bolstered that up, that helped. We've always grown to annual plans. So we're always pretty well on deck with our annual plans in terms of where we think the company will go and what we think we'll have available to use to invest in parts of the company. But we do put a pretty rigorous metrics over the business. When we're thinking about applying capital, we look at applying it where we get the best return, be that equipment or plant or opening markets or whatever. And we're pretty strong on that. We're governed by a board, which we've appointed to keep us on the straight and narrow. And they're shareholders as well now. They're part of the NEM family more for their insight and strategic guidance than their capital. And then we have a really strong scientific advisory board driving the R&D projects. But our R&D model is, we took a different direction to a lot of companies who've spent gazillions on R&D, but we've taken a different model where we've actually acquired the IP and the smart people and access to seven world-class laboratories, and everything's in a really applied project management framework, which is a different way to look at R&D.
You mentioned something that piqued my interest around working on the business instead of in the business, and some of those systems and frameworks and processes are definitely examples of that. Is there anything that you as the leader do in the day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month to make sure you're working on the business instead of in the business?
I don't have any meetings on Fridays. And I sometimes glance through emails, but Fridays are no meeting days for me. They're just reviewing the week and the month and how we're going. I've done it for years. It's the no meeting day. It's not go to golf day. It's just a day where I just say, this is the day where I just sit and think about things and pick up the phone and talk to the team on bits and pieces, what's on their mind, where I invest. And the other 4 days a week are all external on the travel or, you know, dealing with what has to be dealt with.
Taking a step back from the tactical, Ben says he's been heavily influenced in his strategic thinking by New Edge's chairman, who advises laser focus on core competencies.
Keep the strategy really simple and stay focused on it. It's so exciting to charge up and down dry gullies and look at new things. But if the strategy's sound, just keep on going at it and just let that flywheel get its momentum, right? And there it is. It's just more products, more customers, more revenue, more profit, more research, more products, more customers. So it goes around. That's the best bit of advice I can give anyone is we can spend days and months and years trying to get the killer strategy. Just needs to be simple and understood by everyone, and the leadership of the company have to hold true to the strategy. And it needs to be founded in really good data and rigor before you set it. Not because it's a good idea.
As you look ahead to the market here, more pressure on input prices, sustainability, responding to climate change, what are some of your insights, or what are you excited about in terms of what you think is going to be successful here in the next 10 years of farming and agriculture?
I think there's a heap of opportunity if we're prepared to open our eyes to it. Our research program has key elements to it, but one is centered around carbon sequestration Another one is on abiotic stress and dealing with getting high yields in dry climates and dry situations. Another major project is nitrogen use efficiency and fixation in cereals. And the last one is to find a way to release phosphorus, which is what all the big companies around the world like us are trying to do. But they're the big addressable areas that I think will open up the jaws and the margins in agriculture over the next decade. And I think they're the ones that farmers will embrace because they understand it really well and it can be put into their farming system. So they're the big opportunities for us. There is no doubt the world's view on carbon is going to change the agricultural landscape. And I think there's no doubt in my mind that the consumer sentiment that we're seeing in Europe and extending across the world around what their food has to have in it and the traceability and the fact that governments are now legislating to reduce the use of synthetics because of the carbon footprint of synthetics. The writing's on the wall, I think, for where we're going, and I see that as not a threat. I see it as a great opportunity, and that's exactly what positioned them in the position it's in now.
What challenges do you see in particular for that kind of adoption and practice change? You mentioned before, like underpinning confidence and sharing that data and being transparent. You mentioned some of the challenges around growing the business in terms of investment into research, having those solid partnerships. I think especially on the grower side and kind of adoption side, what challenges do you foresee as we make this transition away from synthetics and have more biologicals and more of these pressures? What's that going to be like for farmers?
If I connect the dots on it, in my mind, the producers of synthetic fertilizers and chemistry, and I'm not saying that's not for the future, I'm just saying if I think there's a mix or a balance between biologicals and chemistry that's starting to appear and synthetics, but if I connect the dots and think about the cost of production of synthetic inputs into agriculture today, and I think about the impact of what a carbon impost is going to mean to those manufacturers of those products, they're going to pass that on to agriculture, right? And agriculture is going to bear the brunt of the increased price of those inputs is how I see it. Now, agriculture has to obviously look at finding ways of increasing soil carbon or fixing nitrogen and other things like that so as to get the balance right on their P&L to maintain their profitability. I think it's a policy-driven outcome around the world that will see farm inputs continue to rise in price.
How about the entrance of other kind of related technologies? One we've looked at a lot is autonomy. And if you've got the potential to do non-chemical weeding or to spread or spray in different ways or to have a microwave or a chipper that attacks a weed seed bank because you know where it exists pre-emergence, any of those kind of more digital technologies with some of the inputs?
Look, I'm 100% for that. I can see that playing out really well. I can see that as being a really interesting space. And it is now, isn't it? If you think about the investment that's going into it, it's going to be a couple of approaches. I think it's going to be, probably three: water use efficiency, on-farm production technology around building up the benefits of the soil, or, changing the input of the fertilizer and chemistry. They're the three big areas that I see at work. And if I look around the world, that's where most of the investment's going. And at the farmers and I look at some of the field days we've been to over the last 2 or 3 years, those sites and those companies attract a lot of interest. So I think farmers are great innovators in the main, and particularly the leading farmers. It's the sort of stuff that I think will be adopted. The question will be the cost of developing the technology versus the time to have it adopted at a level that makes it a profitable business could be a challenge.
If you were starting out your career today, Ben, and thinking about what areas you'd get involved in, biologicals, I imagine, is one. What else would be on the top of your list to be checking out in this world of agriculture and technology?
I think the most exciting thing that they could be looking at is the productivity gains that can be made by the adoption of some technologies or an amalgam of 3 or 4 and really do some good work on that. I think there's a lot of learning to be done there. There's a lot on offer. But I find that really something when you've got that quiet time to think about. You think, what's out there and how do you pull it all together? I see what's happened in the last 30 years in farming, where we've gone from Longfellow and small equipment to rotational cropping and big gear and efficiency, and now all of the stuff to do with controlled traffic and linking your spray rigs to your harvesters. That's been the change I've seen. And then I look at what's on offer now, these new frontiers in biologicals and weed control, satellite measurement of soil. And I look at all that and I think, gee, that's, the next decade is going to be really exciting. But I really think we're in a different space globally at the moment than we might have been for the last decade in terms of farm input costs. I just see that as a real challenge coming up because of all these global pressures. So all this technology theoretically should help us maintain our competitiveness. So bring it on, I say, as quickly as possible.
Ben's experience offers a lot of insight into not only the biological space, but also the intersection of production, agriculture, and entrepreneurship. In the biological space, this market is growing fast, and its pace is accelerating. Investing in deep, sound science and transparency with farmers, combined with carefully controlling shipping and logistical constraints, all with an eye to the global marketplace, has been an effective strategy for NewEdge so far. For founders out there, Ben's advice to know yourself and your weaknesses, or as he says, looseness, is what is really necessary to hire the right team, which is the source, in his opinion, of a company's value and momentum. This work goes to strategic partnerships as well, where Ben's advice is to go slow and ensure you're well aligned with your would-be partners, from operators in your global network to university researchers. And for farmers who are interested in investing beyond the farm gate, the realization that diversifying an ag portfolio with businesses less affected by the seasonality and cyclicality of production is a key one for Ben. Beyond that, investing in solutions that he can use has given Ben a way to shape the kinds of technologies that would help his own farm, and in that way, stay ahead in a rapidly changing world. So that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. Thanks again to our guest, Ben Barlow, Managing Director of NewEdge Microbials. And of course, thank you for listening. For more information on any of the resources mentioned in this podcast, please visit our website, agtechsowhat.com. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time.